Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. We continue, for the next few minutes at least, a conversation with Dr. Terry Mortensen, speaker, writer, and researcher for Answers in Genesis, based in Petersburg, Kentucky. Charles Darwin was born 197 years ago yesterday. Little biography on Darwin, and then your questions and your comments as well. Open Lines follows this, and we'll be doing our sermon review. This time, D. James Kennedy is preaching a sermon from Coral Ridge, from his pulpit, and he's going to talk about whether or not Abraham Lincoln was a Christian. We'll do our sermon review with our three-part diagnostic coming up in just a few minutes. Dr. Mortensen, let's go back to the phone. Let's talk with Betty in Lake St. Louis. Betty, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. I would like your guest comment on the argument that just as God created Adam as a mature adult and not as an infant, could he have created the earth as a mature earth?
Okay, thank you, Betty. It's a good question. Dr. Mortensen.
Certainly there was a sense in which it was a perfectly suited for life, but it wasn't instantaneous. The earth was first created covered with water, and then dry land appeared on the third day, and then he created the vegetation, and then he created the life forms. But certainly there was a mature creation there. Now, the problem is, well, let me just add one thing. If we look at what it says about the plants, they were created with fruit already on their branches and seeds in their fruit. So they were mature. And with the sea creatures and the birds and the land animals, God commanded them as soon as he created them to be fruitful and multiply. So they were at an age, at the moment that they were created, they were ready for sexual reproduction. And the same with Adam. He wasn't created as a little boy or an infant. But we've got to be careful here, because sometimes people have said, well, couldn't God have created the earth with all those sedimentary rock layers with the fossils in them as just giving us an impression that the earth was much older? But those fossils are a record of death and disease. We find cancer in the fossil record. And God could not have created that. That would be deception. Those were really living creatures. We find some creatures that are partially fossilized. And so that then produces a huge problem for those who accept the idea of millions of years, because they have to say that all of that death represented in the fossil record was before Adam was created, which was a time period that God calls in Genesis 1 very good.
So they have to assert either that God was if he created the fossil record embedded in the rocks of the earth with the impression of an old earth that had where death had existed before, either God is being deceptive and laying down really a false record,
right,
open to misinterpretation, or death did pre-exist and therefore the fall into sin is not the origin of death.
Right, and then we can't trust God in that case either, because he's calling this all very good when it really was horrible. The evolutionists talk about five major extinction periods when 70 to 90% of the creatures were wiped out, and this could hardly be part of a very good world.
How then would you explain the evidence of the fossil record?
It is largely the record of Noah's flood. It is a sobering testimony to the judgment of God against a sinful world 1,600 years after Adam and Eve sinned. Now, some of the sediments were deposited in the pre-flood period between creation and the flood, but most of the fossils were laid down by the flood. Some of the fossils in the uppermost layers would be the result of residual catastrophic events after the flood. But creationists believe that most of the geological record of fossil layers was a result of the flood.
So very recently, National Geographic magazine, I think it was the latest one, in fact, had its feature article on the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the assertions made in that article, common assertion, if you go out to the Grand Canyon, you'll hear it all over the place, and they'll show you the various layers, that this was cut by the Colorado River over millions of years, very slowly, and we have just like a slice through a layer cake. We have all of the evidence of those millions of years right there in the walls of the Grand Canyon. What would be the explanation that would fit with a literal six-day creation?
Well, first of all, Todd, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, if you've ever been to the Grand Canyon, to see that that Colorado River story just can't be true, because the Grand Canyon is 4 to 18 miles wide, and the Colorado River, I've been on a raft trip down the river, it's not more than, I don't think it's even 100 yards wide. So it's something else that caused that canyon to be there. And there are even evolutionary geologists who are saying what creationist geologists have been saying is that it was a lot of water in a very short period of time, not a little bit of water over a long period of time. And so in the creationist interpretation of the canyon, the layers were actually laid down by the flood, but the canyon was very likely carved in a period shortly after the flood, as floodwaters were trapped behind an uplift. The northwest side of the Grand Canyon is 1,000 feet in elevation higher than the south rim. And so there seems to be geological evidence of some two huge lakes that trapped water up there northeast of the Grand Canyon, and that lake water draining from the Green River and Colorado River drainage basin, that water kept building up in the post-flood period and eventually breached that natural dam and carved the Grand Canyon as those lakes drained in a very short period of time.
It has become so much of the fabric of how we think and talk. I mean, even Christians who do believe in a literal six-day creation often hear the accounts of millions of years or the explanation for things like the Grand Canyon and say, well, that sounds plausible. We might even catch ourselves saying, well, millions of years ago, and then realize, wait a minute, there was no millions of years ago. It seems as though Darwin has kind of won, after 197 years, won the debate to a large degree. What do you think, Dr. Morton?
Well, he certainly has, as our culture has been completely brainwashed with evolutionary thinking through our public schools, our universities, our museums, our national parks, our science programs on television, and we're just getting the Darwinian interpretation of things all over the place. But the last 40 years, evolution has come under increasing attack by a growing number of people, both young earth creationists and intelligent design people, and even a number of books, Todd, have been written by evolutionists themselves raising serious scientific objections against Darwin's theory. So it's maintaining its dominance today because evolutionists control the scientific establishment, they control the educational establishment, they control the science journals, and they have influenced and intimidated most of the media to believe what they want to believe.
This is what I wonder. Is it here to stay? I mean, is evolution so ingrained in the institution of education, in the thinking of mainstream science, that it's here to stay? Or is it like so many other theories, perhaps a bit more stubborn than most, but deemed to be provisional and then eventually dismissed for something else? What do you think?
I think it's here to stay because, first of all, evolution was not an idea invented by Darwin. His grandfather wrote a book on the subject, had all the basic elements. But the ancient Greeks had evolutionary ideas long before Christ. It's an old idea. Darwin just put new scientific clothes on it to make it seem more plausible. But it basically flows out of a rejection of God as creator, as Romans 1 talks about, and ultimately it is a spiritual issue, and there are many, many evolutionists who will say, no matter how much evidence you present to the contrary, I won't believe in creation because I can't allow God into my thinking. So ultimately it's a spiritual issue, and I think what we're going to see is, and we're already seeing this, that science is going to be probably less dominated by atheism and more dominated by pantheism or Eastern religious ideas, that the creation is divine itself, and that can help explain the design that we see. So I think there'll be a growing number of people who will reject Darwinism, but, you know, the really big problem is the church, and much of the church is still compromised with evolution, which brings us around to where we started with this Evolution Sunday. Thousands of pastors, they're mostly in the liberal denominations, are endorsing Darwinism.
A couple of quick phone calls here as our conversation winds down. We'll go first to Kathy in St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if anybody had asked you the question about the way the word is defined. You know, originally it meant that something changed from one thing into another thing, but a lot of times it's used in casual conversation just to mean something like, you know, a child is evolving. You know, the child doesn't change from a child to a giraffe, but, you know, it's used as a term of adaptation instead of total change. And it's used in casual conversation as well as scientific. They seem to, you know, interchange the meanings. When I hear, you know, scientific shows on television, they'll use evolution, you know, to mean adaptation and also to mean a total change.
Kathy, it's a good observation. Thanks for the call. Dr. Mortensen.
Yeah, that's a very good observation, and that is a huge problem. The evolutionists change the meaning of the word even in the middle of the sentence. They're talking, beginning to talk about, in the beginning of a sentence, about microbe to microbiologist change, and then they throw out examples of variation within the length of hair in a dog, or the change in the color of the feathers of a particular species of birds. And so we're being deceived. You know, I often say when I speak on this subject that I'm changing. I don't look like I did when I was 18 years old, but I am not evolving. If anything, I'm devolving. I'm on the way down, not on the way up. And so we constantly need to emphasize that the issue is, how do you change a single-celled creature into all the different kinds of plants and animals? Or more importantly, how do we explain the origin of the genetic information for making those creatures? And the evolutionists want to avoid that issue of information in the genome, the DNA molecule, and just talk about changes.
Here's another caller from St. Charles, Dave, this time. Dave, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I'd like to bring in relative to the Grand Canyon, the experience after Mount St. Helens, the canyon that was cut rather a short time after the volcano eruption, and the water flowing that actually cut down a small canyon type thing, but nevertheless a similar situation. And also just to throw in a situation parallel to what you just said, I just talked to David Menton just this weekend, and his suggestion in coming against someone who's pro-evolution is to press for details. So many times there's no way they can come up with details that they're stopped. So just want to throw that in.
Thanks, Dave. What about the Mount St. Helens incident there?
That has certainly become a key laboratory of catastrophism for creationists, because Mount St. Helens and subsequent explosions after the initial major one in 1980 have shown us the power of catastrophic forces. And your listener there is exactly right. A canyon about 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon was carved in one day by catastrophic mud flow coming down from the mountain about 2 years after the original eruption, and cutting a huge canyon that has the same kinds of features as the Grand Canyon. So before that event, geologists would have said a canyon like that, an erosion feature like that, would take long, long ages to form. But it happened in one day.
The website address for Answers in Genesis is answersingenesis, all one word, .org, answersingenesis.org. That's their website. Our guest, Dr. Terry Mortensen, is a speaker, writer, and researcher for Answers in Genesis based in Petersburg, Kentucky. He joined us to talk about Charles Darwin. Dr. Mortensen, thank you for being our guest, and thanks for sticking around for an extra few minutes.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is a commentary on an Old Testament book that befuddles many, and those who think they have it figured out so often misinterpret this because they leave Christ out of the picture. It's the book of Ezekiel. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on the book of Ezekiel, the first 20 chapters. The book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. You get about 40 minutes to do so today. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at our website. You'll find the Book of the Month on our homepage, issuesetc.org. When you get there, scroll down and you'll find the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Ezekiel, the first 20 chapters, issuesetc.org. Well, D. James Kennedy was in the pulpit at his congregation and on television at the same time, preaching a sermon yesterday. The sermon, while others are, I was in the pulpit yesterday too, I was preaching on, isn't it amazing how quickly the mind goes, I was preaching on the healing of a leper and the will of God. You know, that's what the reading suggested. D. James Kennedy was preaching on Abraham Lincoln and whether or not the former president was a Christian. Now, this is a theme that is common to D. James Kennedy's preaching. In fact, one might say that Abraham Lincoln is a subject to which this preacher returns on a regular basis, usually around the 4th of July, but it was Abraham Lincoln's birthday. So the question is naturally raised in Kennedy's mind, was he a Christian? Well, he's assembled his facts. He's ready to preach his sermon and ready to make his case whether or not Abraham Lincoln was a Christian. Now, before you ask, why does it matter? He'll tell you, I think, in the course of this sermon, why he thinks it matters. Let's listen, though, to Dr. Kennedy's sermon with our three-part diagnostic in mind. Let's listen not so much for Lincoln. We know the sermon's going to be about Lincoln from its title. Let's listen for Jesus Christ. In fact, keep a running tally of how often you hear Jesus mentioned. While you're doing that, if Jesus is mentioned, immediately ask yourself this question. This is part two of our diagnostic. Is he the subject of the verbs? Is Jesus the one who is acting or the one being acted upon? Is he the subject or the object in the sentence? Is he the one driving the action, driving the verbs? That's part two. And if he is mentioned and is the subject of the verbs, go on to part three. What are those verbs? What is the preacher, in this case Dr. Kennedy, telling you that Jesus has done, is doing, will do for you? Are they the verbs of, who knows, in the case of Dr. Kennedy, are they the verbs of the therapist's couch that Jesus is there to help and empower and enable and facilitate? Or are they the verbs that Scripture uses to describe what Jesus does? The one who lives and suffers and dies for you, for sinners. And when you're done with the sermon, step back and just get the big picture, which is, what has the preacher said our problem is, if any? And what solution does he provide in his sermon for that problem? Is it sin, our problem, and God's undeserved favor for Christ's sake? We call it grace as the solution. Is it my sin and Jesus' perfect, sinless life laid down at the cross as a sacrifice? Or is it something else? Or is there no problem whatsoever? Just an easy lecture on a former president. Here's Dr. G. James Kennedy, Coral Ridge Hour, preaching from his pulpit on Sunday, yesterday. The sermon's title was Abraham Lincoln, a Christian.
Abraham Lincoln, worldwide, without doubt, the most beloved of all of our presidents. Though there are still some in this country that may have other opinions. Having been born in Augusta, Georgia, and lived 80% of my life in the South, I think I can speak about this matter without bias. The 16th President of the United States is without doubt everlasting in the memory of his countrymen. For on the battlefield at Gettysburg, he delivered what has been called the most perfect speech ever uttered, not by any president, but by any mortal man. Astounding. But he was uneducated. A little home teaching at first, and then self-educated afterward. And yet he could deliver such a speech as this. Now, all of you have heard and read, and probably some of you memorized the Gettysburg Address, but I wonder how many of you ever perceived what it really is. It is a lengthy personification of America into a person. A fetus, a born baby, a dedicated child, an adult, one who is facing great opposition, where people are trying to destroy him and others are willing to give their lives to protect and save him, and one who has a new birth of freedom, and one that will never perish. The whole life, from inception to eternity, is described in this magnificent personification. Listen to it again with perhaps new ears.
Okay, before he goes on, he's going to read what else on Lincoln's birthday? The Gettysburg Address, right? Okay. I love the Gettysburg Address. I agree that it is a masterpiece of brevity, of rhetoric. It always amazes me every time I look at it that it was simply dashed off on the back of an envelope on a bumpy train. It just amazes me. And it amazes me that when it was delivered, it was considered to be a failure and has gone on to be the stuff of grade school memorization. And it should be. Well, okay. I think Lincoln was a great guy. The question he's posed is, was he a Christian? Was he more significant than even we think he is because of the greatness of his presidency? Now, I raised the question before, well, if he was, so what? If he wasn't, again, so what? Other than his eternal destiny, which is no small thing, what difference does it make if Abraham Lincoln was a Christian? We'll see if Dr. Kennedy explains or answers that question in the course of his sermon. I invite your questions and comments as well. During our sermon reviews, you're always invited to chime in, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're not going to start it right now because we're up against a break, but when we come back from this break, we'll hear D. James Kennedy. He actually does a great job of reading the Gettysburg Address. And then he goes on to answer his own question. Was Abraham Lincoln a Christian? It's not the 4th of July. I've heard him make this argument before on the 4th of July when he preaches about the founding fathers and other great men in American history, talking about America as a Christian nation. This time he's focusing on Lincoln. If your preacher got into the pulpit yesterday and preached this sermon, today, since it is close to the remembrance of Abraham Lincoln, we'll answer the question, was Abraham Lincoln a Christian? And so far into the sermon, this is what you got, and you realized, wait a minute, he's going to read the Gettysburg Address. Oh, he will tie it all together here in the end. What would you think if your preacher was preaching this on Sunday? We'll be right back with more of our sermon review and D. James Kennedy.
Christ-centered, cross-focused. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Todd Wilkin here, talking with Dr. Dean Wenthe, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Wenthe, tell us about Concordia Theological Seminary as a worldwide outreach.
We have, at latest count, about 23 different countries represented on our campus. We have a full-time staff member teaching in Lithuania, another in Siberia, and then our resident faculty teaches regularly in Kenya, in Haiti. We just recently received an invitation to teach in Madagascar. So our commitment is to be a light on the hill and to broadcast the light of Christ into all the world.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit them on the web at www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. If you can't beat them, keep them from showing up for the game.
That's the tact Wisconsin evolutionists and liberal lawmakers are taking in attempting to ban the study of intelligent design in public schools. Kim Troby reports on the Wisconsin proposal.
The bill's language says only testable scientific theories and those okayed by the National Academy of Sciences can be taught, meaning evolution. Sponsor Therese Berceau was unavailable for comment, but is quoted as saying it's designed to promote good science. William Dembski, ID proponent and author, calls that misleading.
Good science includes presumably archaeology, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and forensic science. There are plenty of special sciences that depend on drawing the distinction between intelligent causes or intelligent agents and physical causes. She's already going into this saying that intelligent design has been discredited.
He thinks the legislation might backfire.
The majority of the U.S. population favors some form of intelligent design. Once you start saying you cannot teach intelligent design, you're in a sense putting evolution on a pedestal to be knocked down.
Alliance Defense Fund senior legal counsel Gary McCaleb wonders about the testability claim of evolution, but also says they're ready to help with the legal end of the battle.
We're always ready to look into these kind of situations. I think it's certainly curious when you see scientists acting as censors. Whether there's a legal issue, we'll wait to see, but definitely something to look into.
Dembski believes ID critics will only end up looking foolish for resorting to political action to suppress the teaching of opposing theories. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
The bill allows discussion of intelligent design in non-scientific context. You can even discuss it in science class if you explain why it is not a science. Otherwise, it's relegated to religion, social studies, and philosophy courses. For Family News in Focus.
Living Jubilee is a program of interest to people who work or are retired, who have medical conditions or who don't want to develop medical conditions, who spend money or who want to know how to save more, who find people interesting, whether living or historical. Living Jubilee is about vacations and computers and movies and faith. Find out about life on Living Jubilee, live with Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers, Monday through Friday, 11:05 on AM 850. KFUO.
Are the visions and oracles found in the Old Testament book of Ezekiel relevant to God's people today? Our Issues Etc. book of the month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can get more information about this commentary on our website, issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. Our February Book of the Month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We are reviewing a sermon from D. James Kennedy and the Coral Ridge Hour. He preaches these sermons in his own congregation from his pulpit. Now, you might say, hey, what's wrong with the D. James Kennedy? He knows quite a bit of history. What's wrong with him simply telling us what he knows about Abraham Lincoln? Nothing. If he knows about the man and cites his sources and all those kind of things, there's nothing wrong with that. Any place else other than the pulpit on Sunday morning. He was not called there as pastor to preach Lincoln, but Christ, right? So there's our diagnostic. Listen, not for Honest Abe, but for Jesus Christ. We'll see who gets top billing in this sermon by D. James Kennedy. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we go back to D. James Kennedy and his rendition of the Gettysburg Address, let's talk with Kurt, who calls from his car. Hi, Kurt.
Well, Pastor Todd, I was raised in central Illinois in Bloomington, and in grade school I was taught that Lincoln was the fourth member of the Trinity.
Really?
Yeah.
And, no surprise there.
It was only until much later that I learned that I don't think there's a shred of evidence that Lincoln was a Christian. That, from what I know, Lincoln actually trampled on the Constitution and imprisoned many, many publishers and also... I've got someone who wants me here.
Oh, well, and, before I let you go, though, Kurt, do you think it's a fit subject for Christian preaching on Sunday morning from the pulpit?
It's interesting history, but I think that Lincoln is a classic example of a president who used Scripture but didn't really hold Christian views.
All right, Kurt, thank you very much. Okay, now, it's a well-made point. Okay, we don't know that Lincoln's heart of heart, but boy, I tell you what, if he weren't a Christian, he is a prime example, as Kurt has just said. If he were not a Christian, it's a prime example of a guy who knew how to play the part and to employ the language and the symbolism and the terms of the Christian faith to great political effect. Now, what I'm intrigued by is Kurt's assertion that, you know, growing up there in Lincoln, in the land of Lincoln, I happen to be a resident, that Lincoln is held in such high regard. It has become a linchpin in D. James Kennedy's greater argument, which is America is a Christian nation, enjoys most favored nation status with God. It's a linchpin of his argument to show, to demonstrate things like Lincoln was a Christian. And there is a lot of hagiography going on when it comes to Lincoln. It's, first of all, Americans generally don't say bad things about presidents who get assassinated. Unless, of course, you only spent a couple of weeks in office and were assassinated, then you can say everything you want to bad about them. But we tend to elevate assassinated presidents and forget the bad and remember only the good. And we also forget that in Lincoln's day, he was not held in the high regard that he is today. Only the retrospective history has given us that. Oh, he was by some, but by many he was considered worst thing to ever happen. Now, that's something for the historians to debate. I wonder, what's D. James Kennedy doing on Sunday morning in his pulpit playing the historian and not the preacher of Christ? Well, here's the Gettysburg Address. It's always nice to hear, but you can hear it any place. You don't have to go to church to hear this.
Listen to it again with perhaps new ears. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. And yet, in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, but that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. Those last words, government of, by, and for the people.
Okay, before he goes on to make his point, he's just read the Gettysburg Address, kind of waxing a bit Shakespearean there at the end. I mean, maybe he's just feeling inspired, and so the accent, his native British accent, D. James Kennedy, tends to come out. I don't know. Laying that aside, I can open up a textbook of history and read the Gettysburg Address. I can go online, click it, and hear famous people reciting it for me. If you were a grade school student during the right years in the right place at the right time. You might even have it memorized and be able to say it for yourself. And if you can, you might have been able to skip church if you went to Coral Ridge. Just stay home, look in the mirror, affect your British accent, and say the Gettysburg Address. I mean, do we go to church to hear these great words of a great man or something even greater? They're stirring. They're meaningful. They certainly are stirring and meaningful for us Americans. They're great words. Are they great enough to displace the preaching of Christ on Sunday morning? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're doing our sermon review of Dr. D. James Kennedy's sermon on Sunday from Coral Ridge. He has begun his case that Abraham Lincoln was, in fact, a Christian. And he's going to make that case, beginning with the Gettysburg Address, picking up on those words of the people, by the people, and for the people. It's a great civics lesson. That's what makes the Gettysburg Address a great speech. It is quintessentially the American spirit, the American ethos, the American mindset. But you can get that any place. You don't have to go to church for that. The church has something even better.
Those last words, government of, by, and for the people. Lincoln, who, according to Theodore Roosevelt, mastered one book in his lifetime, and that was the Bible, found those words in the introduction to the Coverdale translation of the Bible. By the way, the words, one nation under God, a nation under God, that was the source of the words under God that were placed in our Pledge of Allegiance. Yes, he is everlasting in the memory of his countrymen. But today I would like to ask a deeper question. Is he everlasting in any more significant way?
Okay, let's take a break here. Not a break from you, but a break from D. James Kennedy asking the big question. Was Lincoln more significant than even the significance that history lends to him? He's trying to answer that question. Was he a Christian? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. If you didn't know it was D. James Kennedy, and you didn't know that this was Coral Ridge, and you didn't know that this was Sunday morning, and you didn't know this was delivered from a pulpit, you wouldn't know yet that you were listening to Christian preaching, would you? Let's talk with Bernard, who calls from his car. Hi, Bernard.
Yes, I know the Lutheran tradition since I was raised a Lutheran. But I think after World War One and World War Two, I think it's appropriate that that even in the pulpit that we can give examples of political instruments of evil and political instruments for good. For example, David, one of the great kings who ordered, who basically put somebody in the front of a battle to get killed because he lusted after the man's wife, was certainly revered as a great leader. So I think that when we have people in political power that may want to use Christianity, I think that it's appropriate maybe to comment on these even in the pulpit.
Well, but Bernard, should these, as you say, political instruments for good or for evil as examples, be the subject of Christian preaching?
Well, I think after World War One and World War Two, they should be, because I think the Nazis wouldn't have gotten hold in Lutheran Germany if there had been more preachers which were questioning what they did.
Interesting, Bernard. Well, thank you for the call. So that's why Nazism caught hold, was because Christians were preaching too much Jesus and not enough, what, against Hitler? All right. Rick calls from Culbertson, Nebraska, and he listens on our sister station, KNGN. Hi, Rick.
Hello. I disagree with last caller completely. In the first place, I go to church to listen to the law and the gospel of our Lord and Savior. I don't go to listen to how good someone else has done or how he has led
one great, Rick, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Rick, thank you very much. You know, I've been wondering up to this point in the sermon, what's his text? What Bible passage is this sermon based on? Preaching God's Word, right? I mean, even people who don't, and there are a lot of people who disagree with me that Christ needs to be in the pulpit every Sunday for every sinner, they disagree with me vehemently. They say it's a completely unreasonable, irrational thing to ask of preachers in this day and age. Oh, no, 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 not Jesus every Sunday. Come on. But even those who disagree with me on that, say, for instance, Pastor Ted Haggard of the National Association of Evangelicals, he at least agrees that it needs to be the Bible. So where's Lincoln in the Bible? Now, back to Bernard's point, if you're going to talk about David, well, at least you can find David in the Bible. That's a step closer, perhaps. Not much closer, but it's a step closer. Lincoln was a great man. I think he was a little late to get included in the Bible. So what about other religions offering testimonials on how politicians, celebrities, etc., have been influenced by non-Christian religions? Yeah, I mean, why not? If this is what Christians ought to be doing. I don't know, maybe in a Muslim country, what? The imam gets up on Friday worship in the mosque and says, today we will entertain the question, was the late Ayatollah Khomeini a Muslim? Doesn't have to go to the Quran for that one. What would make the message essentially any different? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Tim, who calls from his car. Hi, Tim.
Hi there, Todd. I think he could have preached Christ through using Lincoln as an example of Christianity. I think he could have said that it was Christian, that Lincoln, in such a hostile climate, you know, where half of the country wanted him dead, to be able to preach about, you know, freeing the slaves. And you know, I'm sure that the Lord heard all the prayers of these slaves that were beaten and whipped. And you know, I think that he used Lincoln as an instrument of Christianity.
All right. Thank you. It was Tim, right. He could. Let's see if he will. He could, by way of introduction, kind of turn this ship around and get it back pointed at the cross. Will he? That's the question. Will he? He's going to have to work to get it done, but we'll see. Matt calls from Seward, Nebraska, and he listens in on the Internet. Hi, Matt.
This man has completely lost his theological bearings. He's become... He's equating is he about to compare the birth and growth of America with Jesus' life? That's the impression I was getting, that he was getting that conception, conceived in liberty and then rose from the dead.
Yeah.
I mean, no, if I went to church and my pastor did this, I'd be looking for another church. And I'd tell him that. I would say, Pastor, or Mister at that point, because I would seriously question his authority as pastor. This is not what you're supposed to be doing. And I would tell him that try to be in a nice way and say, look, I'm a historian. You come to my class if you want to hear about history, although I don't teach American history. But I'll go to your church and hear about what I need to hear, which is the gospel, forgiveness of my sins in Jesus Christ. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
All right. Thank you, Matt. I mean, I'm just thinking all the historians there who know this better than D. James Kennedy, they could just as well get up and walk out. They've heard it all. They know it. Some of them probably have even written books on it. So what is the church there? What's the pulpit there for? And what's the preacher there for? No matter how much you admire Lincoln, no matter how much you like hearing the Gettysburg Address, no matter how much it stirs the American impulse and the impulse toward liberty in your heart and all those kind of things that are good, is this what Sunday morning is supposed to be for? And don't get me wrong, I will get emails from people today who will say, don't you know that D. James Kennedy does know the gospel? Sure he does. I know he does. So why is he giving Jesus the week off so far? Roy calls from his car. Hi, Roy.
Hi, Pastor. You know, I know I've listened to Dr. Kennedy for a long, long time, and it took me a long time to realize that what I kept hearing was the social gospel. And I think this is an example of the liberal theologians don't corner the market on elite intelligence. And I think Schuller's another example. Kennedy's smart. He knows he can't preach law and gospel to those 3 or 4 or 5,000 people because they don't want to hear that. They'd rather hear soft stories. And I've read some of his books and that are not too bad. But he goes the easy route, I think. And I think a lot of the Reformed people do that, especially in that denomination.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, folks, let's just make it clear. We still have yet to hear some of our sermon here so far, almost halfway through, so far the Gettysburg Address. Bruce calls from his car, then we'll go back to D. James Kennedy. Bruce, welcome.
Yeah, Todd. I went to early church yesterday. I happened to actually hear the sermon. And it was interesting that he pointed out that Lincoln, he tried to say that Lincoln was trying to live by the Ten Commandments, which his mother taught him when he was little.
Mm-hmm.
And and Lincoln said he wasn't a Christian in most of his life, but at the end, supposedly he discovered the gospel and realized that. And Kennedy made the point that the commandments really, there's no salvation in the commandments, and it's strictly Jesus. So I mean, I think he did bring it back around, but I agree, it's kind of an obtuse way to approach law and gospel.
It is an indirect way. I mean, I could spend my pulpit time talking about any great person of history and say, oh, by the way, before I let you go, let's get this background to Jesus. Now, the cross is still mentioned, and the gospel still gets preached, perhaps along with the law, but it's what I call the gospel footnote sermon or the gospel afterthought sermon. It's there. It's just not the main thing. It's tacked on at the end. All right, let's move on. He's finished the Gettysburg Address. Now he's going to talk about what it means, whether Lincoln was a Christian.
Some people have no hope other than perhaps they will be remembered by their children or grandchildren. I've asked many people what was the name of their maternal great-grandfather, and most people can't even tell you that. So, my friends, if that's your hope, it's a very poor hope indeed. Christ offers us not merely a memory, but a living, vital, everlasting existence in heaven. Did Lincoln have that? Ward Lamond, who knew him perhaps better than anyone, had been his law partner, his secretary, and his bodyguard. He said that the melancholy that virtually dripped from Lincoln when he walked was due to his lack of religious faith. But then the worst disaster of a disastrous life hit him. His mother, whom he loved above all, died when he was but 9. His sister Sarah died young. The woman that he loved, Ann Rutland, she could never have. He married a woman who could see nothing good in him at all. But the worst tragedy was in the White House when his beloved little boy, Willie, died. He sickened, and they stood by his bedside, Lincoln and his nurse, and for days and days they stood there, and finally the little boy died. Lincoln was crushed. In fact, that was on Thursday, and every Thursday thereafter he had a day of mourning. He would receive no visitors. He was crushed. Dr. Vincent was a clergyman from New York who happened to be a friend of Lincoln's wife, and he came to Washington to visit, and he was invited to the White House. And when he heard about this weekly day of mourning, he said to the president, "Mr. President, this is wrong." Lincoln was sitting in an easy chair, wasn't really paying any attention to what the man was saying. He was deep in depression. He said, "It's wrong for you to do this. Don't you realize that your son is alive, that he's alive in paradise with God?" And Lincoln suddenly had a jerk, a glimmer, as if he caught on a word. The word was alive. "What did you say?" "I said, your son is alive." He said, "Alive? Alive?" And Lincoln leaped to his feet and threw his arms around this pastor and said, "Do you mean that?" He said, "Christ said that God is not a God of the dead, but of the living. And it's one of the great doctrines of Christianity that he is alive forevermore with Christ." Lincoln grabbed him and put his head on his shoulder and wept, alive, alive.
Okay, now, granted, I am stopping it before he's made his point from the story, and he tells this story quite a bit. Jesus has been mentioned, and he's talking about eternal life and being alive with Christ. Is that the gospel? Certainly something that Christians believe on the basis of the gospel. Why is Lincoln's son alive with Christ? What does Christ have to do with that? Is he just up in heaven welcoming everyone into his presence? Has this Jesus done anything? Has he ever come down from heaven? Or is he just a divine being off there who waits for you to get there? Now see, you can hear the word, the name, the title Christ, and think, oh wow, I think I just heard the gospel. Not necessarily. That's why we have the three parts to the diagnostic. If Jesus is mentioned, is he the subject of the verbs? And then, what are those verbs? Very important part of the diagnostic. Does he get to the cross? Does he get to what Jesus did to save people like Willie Lincoln and Lincoln and you and me? Let's listen for a few more minutes here. And no? No? Oh, okay. Craig's still working on the piece over there. We will be lapping this over into the next hour of the program, into hour three, and then we're going to be joined by Dr. Uwe Simonetto. We continue our series on lay vocation. We'll be talking about the scientist and a little bit about intelligent design with Uwe a few more minutes after this break, and then Wesley Smith will join us right around mid part of the last hour to react to Missouri Senator Jim Talent's position on stem cell research. He's taken his name off a big Senate bill that would ban all human cloning. He says he's still against all human cloning, but he's taken a position, an interesting position, that Wesley's simply going to have to explain to us. Does this represent a bit of a retreat from the issue on the part of the senator from Missouri, Jim Talent? We'll talk about that in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. When we come back, we'll finish up. We'll let D. James Kennedy finish up his sermon on whether or not Lincoln was a Christian, preached from Coral Ridge during the Core Religion Hour from the pulpit there yesterday, Sunday. And we'll take your questions and your comments as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. A little bit more of our sermon review after this break. Hour three is next. Uwe Simonetto and Wesley Smith along as well. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.